The Symphony No. 4 in B-flats by Ludwig van Beethoven, performed by the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Simon Rattle. A work they first performed here at the Royal Albert Hall under Herbert von Karajan back in 1973, when I'm told the Proms prospectus for the entire season's events cost a princely 20 pence. And the fourth is a symphony that seems to have suffered at the hands of its neighbours, the Eroica Symphony and that most famous fifth. Robert Schumann called the fourth a slender Grecian maiden between two Nordic giants. Back onto the platform comes Simon Rattle, stopping halfway, pointing out some of the principal wind players, bassoonist Daniele Damiano, and going and shaking the hands of the members of the orchestra responsible for some of that fabulous wind playing, particularly in the second movement. Oboist Albrecht Meyer, principal flautist Daniel Paud, and now the entire wind and brass section take a bow, followed by the strings, led by Daishin Kashimoto. Simon Rattle nodding his approval to all of them before bowing to the promenaders once again. And the quality of the string sound, especially when they're playing pianissimo, is outstanding, quite breathtaking. The Berlin Philharmonic's bringing us tonight the concert with which they launched their new season at home in Berlin's Philharmonie just last week, which reached a bigger audience than usual thanks to a live broadcast of the concert to over 60 cinemas all over Europe, from Austria and Belgium to Poland and Russia, too in the UK as well. And as well as free public viewings in Hamburg, Dresden and Cologne. If you think that's a big audience, wait till you've factored in the orchestra's other auditorium, its digital concert hall online, which broadcasts 30 concerts a year and then archives them. And don't forget that this Radio 3 broadcast has its own online audience, as always. More over the next week using the iPlayer. And I hope you'll audition the new extra high-quality audio stream for the Proms, which launched earlier this evening, an experiment from this Berlin Prom to the last night. You'll find it alongside the normal streams on the Proms website, where on the front page you'll see a box marked high-quality listening. Do try it. Let us know what you think. It's an experiment, and I'm told that any feedback will be appreciated. Well, when the Berlin Philharmonic first visited the Proms in the mid-70s, Beethoven was undoubtedly the most popular symphonist on record and in the concert hall. But these days he seems to be being usurped by a composer who's become central to our appreciation of Austro-German musical tradition. In the second half of this evening's Berlin Philharmonic Prom, we're going to hear the work that introduces the symphonic world of Gustav Mahler, his first symphony, for which Sir Henry Wood himself was an early champion, giving the British premiere at the Proms in 1903. First, though, we've more from the Proms Literary Festival, recorded earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music. Here's Anne McElvoy.
So hello and welcome to the Royal College of Music and this year's Proms Literary Festival. We're listening to Sir Simon Rattle conducting tonight, an honorary Berliner who's made his home at the Philharmonia in the heart of Berlin. In this literary prom, we'll be exploring the fascination the city's had over 20th century writers and artists. And joining me now is Philip Kerr. His Bernard Günther series of crime novels is set in Berlin, and they feature the city with all its grime and grandeur as a kind of character in its own right. We'll also be hearing some extracts from writing about Berlin from the actor Claire Higgins, and please welcome them both now. Now, Philip, you've got a long-held fascination with Berlin, as evidenced by the fact that you've set, I think, now your seventh novel there. Mm. What first attracted you to the city?
I suppose movies, actually, that I'd seen, books I'd read. The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, the Cabaret with Liza Minnelli.
But it has had a fascination, hasn't it, in many incarnations for writers and artists, both German and from the outside?
Well, it's had so many incarnations. That's the interesting thing about Berlin. It's a kind of city of the 20th century, although a 20th century that starts in 1871 with the unification of Germany. And there are five separate periods, 1871 to 1918, the Hohenzollern period, the Weimar period that comes up to 1933, then the Nazis till 1945, then the Cold War, which is then followed by the second reunification. So two unifications sort of bookending possibly one of the most fascinating periods in history. So every time you sort of think you know everything about Berlin, you find out something new. It's constantly reinventing itself. Anyone who's been to Berlin will know what I'm talking about. It's just like one huge building site. And oddly enough, it's the same. It's the same thing that's happening now as happened in 1871 after Kaiser Wilhelm I decided this was going to be his capital city. There was a huge amount of building that went on and a huge amount of emigration that happened. And this is history is repeating itself. There are people moving in from the east now and new buildings going up all the time.
You mentioned the lure of what we might call Isherwood Berlin, cabaret, the Brecht period, and the accompanying whiff of sex and scandal, and the idea of Berlin as a place where all sorts of forbidden things were allowed. It has a terrific grasp on the imagination, even today, doesn't it?
Oh, it does. I think, in Isherwood's day, of course, I mean, Isherwood went because Auden had asked him, and Auden went, in reality, to suffer. This was a very important thing for Auden. And when he went in 1928, he thought it was important to be in a really poor area and to have intercourse and with the working class. When he got there, he discovered that actually literal intercourse with the working class was incredibly easy. He actually wanted to meet rough German boys to have sex with. And immediately he was there. He thought, God, this is marvellous. And so Isherwood hot-footed out there, and so did Spender and many others. And of course, a number of factors had made Berlin cheap. There'd been, the currency, the crash, the depression. It was jolly cheap to be a libertine. When the crash happened in 23, artists and writers sort of flocked to the place because you could live. I mean, Hemingway writes about an occasion when he goes there with like a sort of $100. And on his first day, he manages to get through 19 cents. And has lived like a king for the entire day and describes, this fantastic experience for a writer of actually, living like a king and still having money left in your
pocket. And it being socially
pocket.
Acceptable to be just creative but not earning a lot of money, because it's not a city that's obsessed perhaps by money in the way that Hamburg or Munich is.
Well, no, Berlin's always been a very left-wing city, which is another reason people have distrusted it. I mean, Hitler hated it because it was the most left-wing city in Germany.
But as we know from Weimar, the party had to stop and everything changed with the rise of the Nazis and the onset of war. And the first reading we're going to have is the American diplomat William Russell, who witnessed Berliners listening to Hitler on the radio following the declaration of war. Claire.
I stopped in front of a radio shop where a large crowd was collected on the sidewalk to listen to an outside loudspeaker. Martial music blared from the radio. The Germans talked happily amongst themselves. We waited for an hour, hearing the stirring music all the time. Finally came the voice of Adolf Hitler. The crowd on the sidewalk was deathly quiet. Der Führer spoke for 40 minutes. It had finished, and the rousing sound of Sieg Heil, Sieg Heil came through on the noisy loudspeaker. There was no mention of the new peace in any sentence. The Germans on the sidewalk around me were puzzled. Could it be that everybody in Germany knew that peace had arrived except Hitler? Had nobody told him?
Everyone always imagines, you see, that the Berliners and Germans were desperate for war. Well, the reality is slightly different. Berlin is being very left. Even after Chamberlain had gone on the radio to declare war, Berliners felt that this couldn't be true. And there was a rumour which had gone round Berlin that a late peace, was about to be negotiated, which is why they were queuing up outside radio shops in the hope that Hitler would say something that would convince them that a peace was on the way. So that they weren't the sort of, war-mad nutters that we always imagined them to be.
And this is the view, obviously, of an American diplomat, but who also has a ringside seat. So he is watching this all unfold. I suppose as a writer who dealt extensively with Berlin, the way that's been your job as well.
I was always interested in the experience of the ordinary man in Berlin. It always puzzled me there were no kind of social histories of what it was like to be an ordinary Berliner during the Nazi period and during the war. And that was what I wanted to read. I didn't want to read sort of huge, great sort of magisterial histories about life in the bunker and sort of Mussolini coming for dinner and all that kind of thing. I wanted to sort of find out what it was like for ordinary people. And a lot of history is sort of concentrated on a minority who were persecuted, which is right and proper. But equally, very little of it has actually sort of concentrated on the majority of people who were German and what it was like for them. And that was the thing that fascinated me, was, you know, how they could live their lives while all of this was happening, and what it must have been like to sort of walk this kind of moral tightrope all the time.
And you have this great ambiguity, don't you? This difficult lefty, proletarian, lots of it city, which had often voted for the left parties, suddenly finding themselves as the war capital, and it is the capital of the Reich.
Yes. Well, of course, I mean, except say Hitler very quickly left and sort of spent most of his time at the Berchtesgaden or the Wolf's Lair or somewhere else. So, I mean, the minute the first bombers arrived, he was out. Really, so as a war capital, it's very much like London in a way, I suppose, because both our city and their city were at the heart of what was going on. The bombers, and just as London is a city where you walk around and see historic ghosts all the time, so is Berlin, but more so. When I go to Berlin, I hardly see the new buildings for looking for the old ones and seeing the ghosts of what was there. I had a rather curious experience. I had to take a party of Spanish journalists on a little tour of Berlin, the first thing they wanted to see was the site of Hitler's bunker, which is now a car park. So I was walking around this car park and saying, well, you see that BMW over there? Well, that was Hitler's bedroom. And they all immediately went over and took a picture of this BMW, actually.
Yes, something's changed beyond recognition. But as you say, ghosts in Berlin have a long literary resonance as well and have fascinated many people who are big writers in the present but have often dealt with the recent past. And I think I'm going to guess that your next writer might be John le Carré, who defines really the writing about Cold War Berlin and gives it his unmistakable presence. The Spy Who Came In From the Cold really did create the picture that many of us carry in our heads in Berlin as the city of watchtowers, spies and mutual misdoings by the great powers. And here we're going to hear from le Carré as he sets the scene for the defection of the spymaster Kahler in Smiley's People.
He had known Berlin when it was the world capital of the Cold War, when every crossing point from east to west had the tenseness of a major surgical operation. He remembered how, on nights like these, clusters of German policemen and Allied soldiers used to gather under the arc lights, stamping their feet, cursing the cold, fidgeting their rifles from shoulder to shoulder, puffing clouds of frosted breath into each other's faces. He remembered how the tanks waited, growling to keep their engines warm, their gun barrels picking targets on the other side, feigning strength. He remembered the sudden wail of the alarm klaxons and the dash to the Bernauerstrasse or wherever the latest escape attempt might be. He remembered the fire brigade ladders going up, the orders to shoot back, the orders not to. The dead, some of them agents. But after tonight, he knew that he would remember it only like this, so dark you wanted to take a torch with you into the street, so still you could have heard the cocking of a rifle from across the river.
Now, be honest, Philip, is every writer nowadays who writes about Berlin haunted by the presence of le Carré?
Oh, definitely. He's the master, without a shadow of a doubt. The first time I went to East Berlin, it was actually like being in The Spy Who Came In From the Cold myself. I am unashamedly one of these people who kind of laments the passing of the wall. It was one of the most exciting experiences a writer could have, was to walk into the East, to come up from the S-Bahn station at Friedrichstrasse and walk into this kind of wasteland. I mean, it was like the Soviet tanks had left, a couple of weeks before. Bullet holes in everything. And it's completely different now, of course. I mean, you come up from Friedrichstrasse S-Bahn station, and the first thing you see is a sort of Versace shop, and the place is just a kind of shopper's paradise.
But one thing Le Carré uses sedulously, really, throughout his work, is the theme of things not being quite as they seem. It's what keeps us on tenterhooks, and it's what drives his plots, but it's also what makes Berlin work, isn't it? Because everything has been something before.
Yes.
And it's like you say about the Friedrichstrasse, it's often been entirely different just a few years ago.
Oh, yeah, and I mean, the street names are the thing that really fox you if you're not careful. I mean, it's quite common to be on a street that's had, you know, maybe three or four different names. And there was a Hohenzollern name, which was, you know, got rid of by possibly even got rid of during the Spartacus time, then got changed under Weimar, then the Nazis changed it again. Budapest-Pesterstrasse became Hermann Göring-Strasse, and now it's called something else. It was something else again. And so there's so many incarnations that Berlin's had. It's almost impossible to know where you are sometimes. You know, I've actually been in a taxi and asked to go to Budapest-Strasse by mistake, and you know the guy sort of looked at me as if I should be much older than I am.
A top tip is never to ask for the main station because they keep moving it depending on where the four-power agreement was going at any time. The character Carla that we heard mentioned there is one of the greatest incarnations in Le Carré. Of course, he had a real East Berlin equivalent, didn't he, in Marcus Wolf, the spymaster who I worked with for a while when I was co-writing his memoirs, and he said he was absolutely haunted by this literary character because he said, well, it was him, but it wasn't him, and sometimes he was very proud of it, and sometimes he just wanted to push it away. The thing of turning things into literature, are you turning your experience of Berlin and your feeling into a detective? What crystallised that?
Well, I sort of didn't set out to be a detective writer or a crime writer because I got interested in German history and the life of ordinary Germans. That was really what I wanted to write about. Berlin was the thing I wanted to write about. And it was, because it was so, everything was so difficult to find out, like I was saying about the street names and how, for instance, Berliners don't particularly want to sort of describe what it was like, so there are not many books about it. It was kind of like being a detective myself. After a while, I thought, well, this is actually good idea that actually I write about a detective, and almost simultaneously it came to me that, you know, that would create all sorts of opportunities to be morally ambiguous, because I'm not really I don't really like writing about heroes, and I don't really believe in people who are just total heroes. It's much more interesting if you're a writer to write about people who have a dark side and who do things that they feel guilty about. And quite often, also for me, it was a way of exploring the question that I think we all ask ourselves sometimes, which is what would I have done if I'd been in that situation? And kind of every book I've done about this, this has always been the question which has sort of been in front of me, which is what would I have done if I'd seen a Jew being beaten up on the Kurfürstendamm? What would I have done if someone had said, you know, come with me to the Gestapo and tell me the truth about this person or we'll torture you? That's the question. And it's a very important question that I think it's important that we never stop asking ourselves, really.
I have to ask, given that you said you arrived and you first lived in the West, and then you took your first walk in the East, so are you by preference an Aussie or a Vessie? Which side would you have preferred, apart from the politics, which side would you preferred to be on?
Well, now I'm a very definite Aussie, actually, because I have to confess, I always stay at the Adlon Hotel, which is just behind on the wrong side of the Brandenburg Gate, if you know
what
I mean.
That's being Eastern at a very high level, I think, actually. God,
I think
a lot more people would want to bring on socialism in that case.
I'm always fascinated whenever I look out the window, and I just, because I can't help but look at it and see, you know, a minefield and sort of barbed wire, and it's just the most staggering view. Now, I mean, if you're under 45, I think it's impossible to imagine what it was like. It seems such a ridiculous thing to do, to have a wall run right the way through the centre of a city.
Well, we'll move from the Cold War to the Berlin of underground music dens and all-night partying and those Berlin flat shares which rarely had the same cast of characters for more than a few months. And here's the singer David Bowie talking about living in Berlin and leaving it.
I had not intended to leave Berlin. I just drifted away. Maybe I was getting better. It was an irreplaceable, unmissable experience and probably the happiest time in my life up until that point. Coco, Jim and I had so many great times. But I just can't express the feeling of freedom I felt there. Some days, the three of us would jump into the car and drive like crazy through East Germany and head down to the Black Forest, stopping off at any small village that caught our eye. Just go for days at a time. Or we'd take long all-afternoon lunches at the Wannsee on winter days. The place had a glass roof and was surrounded by trees and still exuded an atmosphere of the long-gone Berlin of the 20s. At night, we'd hang with the intellectuals and beats at the Exile restaurant in Kreuzberg. In the back, they had this smoky room with a billiard table, and it was sort of like another living room, except the company was always changing.
Would you have liked a night out with David Bowie in Berlin?
I don't think I could have kept up with his relentless nightlife. I think that's probably the best way to put it. I mean, the interesting thing about that piece, I think, is it illustrates what I was talking earlier, is Berlin's an idea. It's a city that seems to belong to the world. Everybody has an impression of Berlin before they go there. They have a Berlin that they've almost created for themselves in their minds. Interestingly, Bowie was no exception.
He also evokes the transience, doesn't he, of that comings and goings, which are quite normal in Berlin, and people don't seem to mind if you just disappear for a while and come back.
No, it's always been a city which has been attractive to immigrants. But people are always coming and going in Berlin. It's that kind of itinerant city, really, and much to the irritation of the genuine Berliners who live there, you know, who hate people like me, probably, you know, who come and write about their city without, you know, actually being a Berliner. But I think that's quite important, actually, is to sort of not be a Berliner and want to write about it. I don't think you have to be. I think it's a city that is almost written about better when it's written by strangers.
But I'm afraid that is where we have to leave it
I
anyway,
think so.
With the ghosts of Berlin all around us. And thank you very much to Philip Kerr and to our reader, Claire Higgins.
Today's Proms Literary Festival programme was presented by Anne McElvoy and produced by Natalie Steed. That was recorded earlier this evening across the road in the Royal College of Music and back here in the Royal Albert Hall. And live on BBC Radio 3, you join me, Andrew McGregor, and a capacity audience eagerly awaiting the second part of this evening's prom given by the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra and its Liverpudlian chief conductor and artistic director, Sir Simon Rattle. That applause for the promenader's announcement of money raised in collections at the end of each concert in the season. Well, we heard Beethoven's Fourth Symphony in the first part, and the second opens in an eerily similar fashion, the mysterious mists of Gustav Mahler's Symphony No. 1. You might have heard Simon Rattle talking earlier about the reasons he's programmed the two works together, those similar openings that both symphonies to some extent come out of the composer's love affairs, and especially the sense that they share a love of nature, showing feelings for the country rather than the city, as Rattle put it. Mahler had been infatuated with a young soprano at the Kassel Opera, where he was music director, the blonde-haired, blue-eyed Johanna Richter. An unhappy affair for Mahler, pretty much a case of unrequited love, but the emotional inspiration for his Lieder eines fahrenden Gesellen, the musical starting point for his first purely orchestral work on a symphonic scale. Mahler was careful to point out, though, that the symphony went far beyond the love story that inspired it. The external event was only the occasion for the work and not its content, he added. And anyway, by the time he was finishing his first symphony, he was in love again with Marion von Weber, the wife of the composer's grandson. It's easy to see how the sense of romantic despair that permeates the songs became a vital part of the symphony, with its themes of life, love, and nature. It started life with a title, The Titan, after a novel by one of Mahler's favourite German romantic writers, and a five-movement layout which he called a tone poem in symphonic form. And the original headings for the movements are evocative. Part one was titled From the Days of Youth, beginning with The Spring and No End to It. Part two became Commedia Humana. But after the first three performances, Mahler dropped the second movement, the title and the headings, so that when it was first performed by this orchestra, the Berlin Philharmonic, in 1896, it was simply billed as Mahler's Symphony No. 1 in D major. From sketches to published four-movement symphony had taken 14 years. Along the way, Mahler had expanded his orchestra, and as well as three offstage trumpets for the first movement's distant fanfares, he asks for the highly unusual number of seven horns. Why? Here's Simon Rattle.
There weren't originally seven horn parts in Mahler 1. He used quite a normal orchestra. Now, what is interesting is that Mahler made his orchestra for what he needed. And he realised that the first version simply wasn't going to work. And I think the truth is that he needed not only horns to play high together, but horns to play low together. So in a way, you have the basic thing of two hands instead of one hand. What's very interesting is that you often get three-part chords with the three lower horns and the other horns above, so that there is an extraordinary warmth. And also, he was knocked out by Wagner's orchestration, who just basically invented the modern orchestra, and he was damned if he wasn't going to use it. And he used more and more.
This evening's conductor, Simon Rattle, on Mahler's orchestration. And here he comes to conduct the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra in Gustav Mahler's Symphony No. 1 in D major, which they first performed under the composer's guidance 114 years ago.
Thank you.